From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from the president and founder of Rishi Tea and Botanicals, based in Milwaukee, about how his business has been impacted by COVID-19.
More people are buying teas online. We've been very well positioned to support tea lovers across the world.
We learn about a new board game called Districts and how it illuminates the issue of gerrymandering through gameplay. Plus, we speak with the Forest Home Cemetery historian to learn about the art and symbolism found on gravestones.
Well, I think it's trying to be solve the mystery, understand the story that's being told by the individuals so that as time passes, they are remembered.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Many businesses have struggled through the pandemic. Others have seen a boom, and some have shifted the way they do business. Rishi Tea and Botanicals, based in Milwaukee, has experienced a little bit of everything throughout the pandemic. Joshua Kaiser is the president and founder of Rishi. He started the company right out of college in 1997, buying herbs, teas, and fruits from all around the world. Kaiser spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver in February about how his business has been impacted by the pandemic and how they've adjusted.
Well, this is the first year in probably 23 or 24 years that I haven't traveled. And I've been traveling all over the world with my buying team 9 months out of every year. And so I've really, it's been a big change for me personally. But when there's change, you have to be flexible and you have to be creative. And I think I've used this time to really focus more on product development, creativity, and focusing deeply on the tea market and supporting my business. The economy, as you know, has been an issue, but people are drinking more and more tea, and that's been good for our business. Unfortunately, we've seen some of our market channels having issues and a lot of our partners in the market suffering because of the closures and the shutdowns, but more people are buying teas online and more people are buying consumer packaged goods delivered to their homes. We've been very well positioned to support tea lovers across the world and shipping direct online. So our online business has grown immensely. And it's been difficult, but we've tried our best and we keep going. My staff that works in the Rishi Tea Herb Lab and the warehouse and the tea blenders and all the packers, I mean, they're there every day dealing with social distancing, temperature checks, all this kind of, you know, this new so-called new normal. They've been working really hard every day to keep teas flowing in the market. So it's been a struggle, but we've been pushing forward for sure.
And I know that you guys had a big partnership with Whole Foods to sell your teas, right? In the retail market, and you say things are picking up more online. Does that include, you know, traditional channels, where traditional grocery stores where your teas were found, but also just going directly through Rishi to get teas?
Yeah, so we see a lot more. I mean, we've been working with Whole Foods and retailers across the country for quite some time. We've seen increase in those markets, and we've seen more brisk sales of a variety of different teas, and herbal wellness teas have been increasing in popularity a lot. People are looking for things to boost their immunity and just maintain health. And I think people gravitate to real tea, which is our business. So we've seen that increasing. We've also seen throughout the country, a lot of the cafes, coffee bars, roasters have shut down, but they've also been very creative to do curbside delivery, different types of delivery systems within their own constellation of business and customers. So we've been supporting really creative businesses across the country. And, you know, our business is thankfully stable, and we see massive increases in leads and new companies opening up, new demand for tea, and we export quite a bit of tea to different countries. So luckily, we're doing all right, and all of our staff in Milwaukee is working so hard to keep it going, and that's not easy working in the factory every day.
And how has, you know, in the life cycle of the tea, from when the communities you get it from and importing it to Milwaukee and then exporting it elsewhere around the world, how has that been affected by the pandemic?
Yeah, it's been really tough. There's an imbalance of shipping containers. There's thousands and thousands of empty shipping containers sitting in the West Coast of the U.S. and a deficit of shipping containers in Asia. So the lead times to book shipments are longer. The cost has nearly tripled trying to import teas via air freight, sea freight. The costs are just insane. And that's been a real challenge because we tried to cast a lifeline to so many of our customers throughout this COVID event and not raise our prices. But at the same time, we're getting squeezed big time because FedEx domestically keeps raising their prices. All these shipping companies are gouging. All importers and manufacturers worldwide are suffering because of the shipping freight rates. I don't know if it's reality or if it's gouging, a little of both probably, but it's not good. We've just put forth price increases across the country because we just can't keep it going without increasing the costs. But basically, the tea exports haven't stopped. People keep shipping. There was a shutdown in India for about 2 months. That started up again. We've been shipping tea nonstop, but it's just been more difficult. And we've been shipping more by air freight when the delays are too great.
Is Rishi still a fair trade, sustainable company, organic teas and things like that?
Rishi Tea is one of the pioneers of organic tea in the U.S. We were importing organic tea before there was a USDA NOP. We went by European Union regulations until 2002 when the USDA implemented the first national organic program. We were one of the first tea companies, and we haven't stopped. I will say that we do fair trade, but we also have our own direct impact or direct trade models where some of the farm groups that we work with are either remote or just are too small to deal with the certification costs or the fair trade scope, or quite frankly, some of the farm groups we work with are fifth, sixth generation amazing farm families that make great money selling tea. Just like some families that make wine in Bordeaux and Burgundy, they're very well off, very rich, because they're artists. So it should be noted that tea is unlike other commodities, where you do have tea that's produced in different parts of the world as commodities, low cost, exploitative wages. Tea is produced below market values or production values. Those aren't the teas that I'm concerned with. We're more concerned with artisanal teas, heritage teas that have amazing characteristics, just like fine wines. So the teas we're buying sometimes are $100, $200, $300 a kilo. The farm groups we work with, they're not suffering. And we pay a premium beyond market value so we can always get the best quality and innovate with the farmers.
How do you create and cultivate a relationship with those farmers and with those communities from which you get the tea? What does that look like, you know, the give and take?
Yeah, there's so many case studies. So some were from my days of after college, just traveling and knocking down the door of different places that I thought housed some famous tea people, or going to special areas that are known for high quality tea and just meeting people. I've maintained those relationships now for more than two decades. I have a network of associates from ethnobotanists to people that work in non-governmental organizations across the world, CARE International, different NGOs I have connections with that help development and agriculture and entrepreneurship in different parts of the world, like the Americas or Southeast Asia. So I maintain relationships via a vast network of people that have passion for plants and tea.
What are your goals post-pandemic when it comes to reishi and what comes to tea in general?
Yeah, natural progression, nonstop innovation of plants and connecting people and plants and making truth out of plant-based diets. Like, it's such a buzzword, and it's such a, I mean, it's almost like it's just a trend, but it's a real life for me, and it's a real life for all the rishis and our partners across the world. You talk about tea, you talk about tea drinks, and you look at these tea drinks out there, it's got citric acid and sugar and all these powders, and they talk about plant-based, but really it's powders or extracts or processed foods. That's not what we want to do. We want to take real plants and make amazing drinks with real plants and deliver them to our friends across the world. So the natural progression for us is making tea drinks and botanical drinks with only plants and water. And that's what we're doing now. And we want to make sure that we could deliver ready-to-drink formats of the best teas and botanicals in the world. So all you have to do is open it and enjoy it.
Joshua Kaiser of Reishi Tea, thanks for sitting down and talking tea with us.
Peace, everybody. Thank you very much.
Joshua Kaiser is the president and founder of Reishi Tea and Botanicals based here in Milwaukee. He spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver in February about how his business has been impacted by COVID-19. You can hear Kaiser give tips on how to brew the perfect cup of tea at WUWM.com. Many people have started keeping houseplants during the pandemic. Coming up in about 25 minutes, we hear from the owners of a new plant shop in Milwaukee focused on sustainability. But first, we'll learn about a new board game called Districts and how it illuminates the issue of gerrymandering through gameplay. That's coming up on Lake Effect right here on 89.7 WUWM. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. 2021 has been an intense year for politics, but it's about to get even more heated. With last year's census completed, it's time now for states to begin the process of redistricting. Over the last couple of decades, redistricting has become cutthroat, as partisan politicians have used the process to entrench their own power through gerrymandering. Although gerrymandering has had a huge impact on our political landscape, it can still be difficult for people to understand its influence. Matt Petering hopes his game Districts can help change that. The game allows players to redistrict a state for partisan gain, and in doing that, better understand how the process can play out. Petering is the owner of Districts Games and an associate professor of industrial and manufacturing engineering at UW-Milwaukee. And he joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in February to talk about his work.
Why create a game to explain gerrymandering?
Well, I think gerrymandering is a complicated issue that a lot of people in the general public perhaps may not be very familiar with. And if you can make a game to help people understand that, that might reach more people than just having a regular textbook that tells it to you on paper. And so I think sometimes by playing a game, you can feel a little bit happier when thinking about a complex topic such as gerrymandering, and a topic that a lot of people have a lot of differing views about and there's a lot of passion about. And if you have a game that might be able to bring people together to understand it a little bit better and bring more people into the fold.
Gerrymandering is one of these issues that I think is bettered by having some visual representations, especially when you're talking about things like cracking and packing districts and explaining to people kind of how these processes work and how they play out in politics. When we're looking at this game, how does it help explore this issue in a way that maybe a lecture or conversation really can't?
The game, it's about strategy and skill. The game is not easy to play. There are a lot of possible ways in which you can divide up a state into political districts. And a lot of times when you just have a lecture on it, they may just show you one way in which it could be divided and that it was gerrymandered. But there are many, many ways you could divide up that state. And to play a game in which you are actually developing the political districts with your opponent in a competitive setting gradually, that gives you the opportunity to take a look at the choices you're making during the game. For example, in a move, you typically are assigning a small part of the state to a political district, and you may want to either say, okay, I want to pack my opponent's voters into few districts and focus on that, or you may want to say, I want to spread my own voters out into many districts. And certainly the decision-making that goes on during this game of strategy really is complex, and you have to think about, certainly those are two possible goals you could pursue in the short run in the game with the overall goal of controlling the most districts by the end.
So it seems like, yeah, the goal is to really rig the map so you're guaranteed a win. To you, how does that square with gerrymandering and how it plays out in real life?
When we think of gerrymandering, we often think about a single party that's in control of both the legislature and the governor's office in a state. And then this single party has total control over the process. In about 35 of our states, the legislature and the governor control the redistricting process. And if a single party has control over both the legislature and the governor's office, they can draw the map however they wish. So in real life, typically we think of gerrymandering as greatly exaggerating the power of a political party. Now, the game is a little bit different in that it says, why don't we set up these political districts by having the two parties play a competitive game against each other? So both parties are at the table, and it's an alternating move game. One party makes a move, then the other party makes a move, and gradually you form these political districts. And so in this case, if both parties are good players at the game, at the very end, the map will be far less rigged than it would be if you had just one party in control. So that's where I think the game is an interesting idea that might actually be worth thinking about for redistricting in real states.
Well, and something that you've created beyond this game. So the game really explores, it seems, how gerrymandering is done, kind of the goals of gerrymandering, although, as you say, in real life, it can be even more rigged than you can really make the conditions in the game. You've also actually created software, which you started to create, it seems, before the game came to fruition. Tell us a bit about this software and what it attempts to do.
Yeah, thank you. Initially, about 4 years ago, I was thinking about, what can I do to make the world more efficient? Because as an industrial engineer, we're all about efficiency and productivity and increasing the efficiency of complex systems. And I did get thinking about our political system, which is arguably the largest system that affects us in our lives. My initial thought was, I want to design a computer program that can create a set of fair political districts. And later on, in the process of doing that, in the middle of that, I had the idea, oh, I could also design a board game. But getting back to the computer program, that was my initial goal in doing work on redistricting. This computer program can automatically generate fair maps of Wisconsin's 99 state assembly and 33 state senate districts. These maps are legally acceptable in that the populations of the districts are nearly equal. Each district is a single connected unit. The districts look nice to the eye. Each senate district consists of three assembly districts, as well as the interests of minority voters are protected in accordance with the Voting Rights Act in both the Assembly and the Senate map. And so that's satisfying the legal requirements, But furthermore, these maps are fair in that the share of the districts that are expected to be won by each party is equal to the share of the statewide vote received by each party in recent elections. The computer program is essentially looking at the 7,000 voting wards in Wisconsin, and for each one, assigning it to one of the either 33 state Senate districts or 99 state assembly districts. Every time I run the computer program, I can get a different fair map that satisfies all of the above criteria for legality and fairness. And so the computer program was actually the first thing I started working on when I started thinking about gerrymandering. And it's actually the last thing that I ended up finishing. The board game was developed kind of in the middle, sandwiched in between the start and the end of the computer program.
But of course, as you say, Wisconsin is very close, whether it's a 1% of people vote Republican more often or 1% of them vote Democrat more often, it's still very close. And yet, of course, our legislature is dominated by Republican politicians.
Yes, exactly. And basically, a lot of political commentators do agree that this is because of gerrymandering. It happened back in 2011 and 2012 when they passed a law that was making the new set of political districts. And at that time, the Republicans did control both the state Senate, state assembly, and the governorship. And so when this happens, and this is happening in a variety of states for both political parties, but when one party controls that process, they can draw the lines of the political districts so that it actually greatly exaggerates their power. It is possible for a party that only has a 50% vote share in a state to draw the districts so they win more than 75% of the districts.
Well, and of course, we've seen a lot of that happening here in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, around the country, in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania, after the 2010 elections, in which the Republicans used a strategy that is now, in retrospect, called Project Red Map, although it may have been called that at the time.
Well, yes, and that is really interesting to see how in a variety of states, I believe, well, North Carolina is another one. Now, Maryland is actually gerrymandered in favor of the Democrats. It's very interesting to see there are many states around the country, I would say about 20, based upon the analysis done by one of my students, in which really the number of people in Congress that represent the state for each political party, it's really not close. It's not close to the proportion of people who support the two parties within that state. So we have a really big gerrymandering problem in about 20 states in the country, I would say.
When you're looking at the software, do you see this as something that states might pick up and try to use? Or to be quite frank with you, we know that these are gerrymandered states. We know that Wisconsin is a gerrymandered state. And it doesn't seem as though Republicans who have done the gerrymandering here in Wisconsin are all that interested in creating fairer maps.
Yeah, well, that's perhaps true. We do want to give them a chance to perhaps have a change of mind and think about the greater good. I think this has to do with how competitive is the United States in general internationally. And I think if we don't have a very representative legislature in many of our states or in the U.S. Congress, this might be affecting our international competitiveness. It's just about political efficiency. Are our lawmakers really responding to the concerns of our citizens? And so certainly, I think that is a concern that people may not listen. But when you have hard facts and data, have a computer program that can kind of automatically create fair maps, this does help the argument for fair maps, because it says a fair map is not something that's just some kind of myth or that's really, really hard to do. Now, I do think the computer code is fairly complicated. It did take me several years, a couple years to get that working. But now that it's working, it's pretty easy. I just click a button and, you know, out comes some data in a spreadsheet. And then I feed that through a visualization tool. And then I actually get a colored map that shows where exactly the districts are geographically in the state for that fair map. And so when you have the ability to do this, I think it does change the conversation a little bit. It's not that, oh boy, the fair map is you know, really hard to do. It's like, boy, I can create 1,000 fair maps for you. And, you know, if we can do that in the computer, why not do that in reality?
Now, going back to the game, districts, when you're thinking about the people who are playing this game, what do you hope they get out of it? What is your intended message to these players?
Yeah, I think the game has a few audiences, which makes it kind of a neat type of game. It's not the typical game that the gaming community is playing, although certainly some people like a really challenging game of skill like chess or Go. And if they like that type of game, they will really like districts. Districts requires a level of skill and strategy that's pretty high. So you have the serious gamers who will like this game. I think anyone interested in politics will also like the game because its theme, it just touches upon an issue that is affecting political life in 21st century America. Also, educators, students in political science and public policy or social studies in high school. I think a lot of students and teachers can get quite a bit out of the game to basically see how districts can be gerrymandered. And finally, I really do think the game really has a message for the political elite. I really think the game introduces a method for dividing a territory into a given number of political districts of nearly equal size, where size is a proxy for population. And so the game actually shares an idea with the world that we can make our political districts in a different way. We may not want to do it the way we've done it before, with letting just the legislature pass a law and the governor sign it to create our new maps. And perhaps some people may not be comfortable with the idea of an independent commission making the maps, because they still, even though it's supposed to be unbiased, perhaps some people still think the final result that the commission created may be favoring one party or the other. And if you don't like that, this game is the solution. The game says, we don't need any third parties. Let's get the two parties in a room and let's have them sit down and play a really difficult game of skill to decide the election districts in the state. So I think the game has quite a few audiences, and it's a little bit different than most other games that have come out recently. And I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Matt Petering is an associate professor of industrial and manufacturing engineering at UW-Milwaukee, and he's the owner of Districts Games. Petering spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in February. Gerrymandering and redistricting are going to be big issues in Wisconsin this year, but they can also be a bit confusing. WUWM has you covered. You can listen back to conversations with gerrymandering expert David Daly about the redistricting process in 2010 and the impact that gerrymandering has had on Wisconsin politics. All of that can be found at WUWM.com. Cemeteries not only serve as final resting places, but as storytellers. One of the ways individuals and families share something about their lives is through monument design. At Forest Home Cemetery in Milwaukee, thousands of gravestones show art and symbolism unique to their history, from the obvious Christian cross to symbols of mourning, achievement, and even hobbies. To help teach us more about the meanings behind these markers, Paul Halbrick, Forest Home Cemetery historian and tour guide, joined me in January. He begins by explaining some of the most common symbols to look for.
They depict occupation is one characteristic of it. They at times depict a person's hobbies or their interests. They also depict religion, which is a very large symbolism topic. They also predict fraternal groups that people were members of, the Masons being the largest, and you'll see the symbol on the markers that are there. And there's a series of other things that have built up over time, but the great period of symbolism was in the Victorian era. And basically in the United States, that was the period of time after the Civil War until the First World War. Everything from flowers having a specific meaning, i.e. lily depicting purity, or oak leaves depicting someone who's a solid citizen, in that concept that's there. So there were two things that were popular in the Victorian era. One was to use Greco-Roman symbolism, which is the temple, which is the primary one that they used. And the other were the Egyptian things that had become popular in the Victorian era, such things as an obelisk, sarcophagus. You'll see many large family monuments use a sarcophagus style for the family information, and then small headstones for each person. So all the emphasis was placed on the design that was used at that point. Mourning, as you indicated, is a common expression. Men may not like to hear this, but we only have women in mourning at the cemetery. There are no images of men in mourning. In terms of women in mourning, one of the more famous spaces at Forest Home Cemetery is called the Beer Baron Corner, where you have the Blatz family, the Schlitz monument, and the Pabst family. And the Pabst woman is in mourning. She's head down, very mournful. And in the Schlitz monument, it's a woman standing on top of the monument pointing to heaven. And that's just the two different styles that are there.
Obviously, the range of markers at Forest Home or any cemetery range from small to massive and ornate. So when it came to incorporating symbols and having a bit more of a complex marker, was this something that usually only the upper class could partake in? I imagine this has always been a more expensive industry, a very labor-intensive thing to design and produce something.
Clearly, the newfound wealth that develops in the U.S. After the Civil War, when we have an expanding industrial base and wealth, plays a role in people identifying their place in society by the monuments that they have. And many of the monuments are not meant for one individual. They are meant to represent the family. And so they have that kind of aura about them, that they're large, important, significant individuals in the community. But the large cemeteries in the U.S., which are in what's called the garden style, which is Forest Home Cemetery, have a lot of the large statuary specific monuments in them. And they tend to be dominated by the very significant names of the community in that particular era.
What's a good example of a peak Victorian era monument we can find in Forest Home?
I think probably the most quintessential Victorian era image is an obelisk. They're large, they're tall, they have that unique feeling to them. And we have some really nice ones in the cemetery. One of the ones that I happen to like the most is the Luick family, L-U-I-C-K. If you were around in the day, you would have known that Luick was an ice cream company. The other things that are, I think, probably quintessential are both the urn, which you find on a lot of monuments. And the urn is Egyptian in nature. And then to stylize it, they would drape it with a piece of cloth that showed reverence for the person that was there. The original purpose of the urn was to take something to the afterlife, but it wasn't being used in that particular fashion here.
Also, something associated with the Victorian era, or of course the Industrial Revolution, but overall 19th century, that unfortunately was infant mortality, right? The rates were very high. It was 50% or more sometimes. So what kind of symbolism do we see in the markers of children's graves?
The most common symbol used is the lamb. And interestingly enough, we have a number of markers that have two lambs on them. And that meant that they were twins and they don't have a name. And that means they were stillborn. Back in those days, you did not name, you do not name a stillborn child. And the reasons for that is that you didn't get your name until you were baptized. That was the thinking back in those days. The other symbols that we have for a child that's stillborn is an empty bed. And there's no name on it. And it generally just says babe or baby. And then if a child dies in the childhood years, and by the way, the childhood years are either 10 or 12, depending on the era that you're in. You grew up quite quick in the early industrial area because you went to work. And in those cases, the symbolism is a child lying in a bed. It's done in that particular fashion. But infant mortality rates in Milwaukee, as anywhere in the United States, were quite high until clean water and sewers came along. And then the public hygiene was increased and mortality rates began to decline. We have child sections at Forest Home back from the 1800s, and they're quite mournful. It's hard to go in and see how many children died. We actually have a couple of sections that are tied to local orphan homes. And back in those days, you would give a free burial to the orphan home. And it was a difficult time.
Yeah. Another marker or symbol found throughout cemeteries is a wreath. Can you explain what that means, whether it's etched onto the stone face itself or perhaps an angel is holding one or a woman even?
Yeah. Generally, it's a woman holding one or it's on the monument itself. The wreath is, it's a laurel wreath, by the way, that's what it would be made of or the makings of it, goes back to the original Olympics when someone won a race, you were crowned with a laurel wreath. And so the symbol is one of victory. But the victory here is essentially the great Christian promise of the victory of life in the hereafter. So that the life in this world, which may have been hard in dealing, the life thereafter would be the great promise. So that's the symbolism there. So generally when a person uses the wreath, they're telling you that they are a Christian. And while some of them may be large, frequently they're small on the marker and you have to kind of get up close to be able to see them. But done in that particular fashion, it is the symbolism of the victory.
Also along the same lines of what we find in nature, of course, very interesting was trees, broken trees specifically. That's not something I even knew existed.
Yeah, it's very Victorian, but the broken tree was a symbol of death. And sometimes it's just a broken branch. But generally, it's the trunk of the tree that is broken. Probably the best examples of this are what's known as a Bedford tree stone. They come from Bedford, Indiana, and they were marketed through the Woodmen of America, which today is an insurance. Back in those days, it was a fraternal organization with an environmental focus. And you could have the tree carved in many different ways, whatever fit. Thing. It could be as small as 2 feet high, or our largest one is about 10 feet high. And then you could have carved onto the tree things that may have been interest to you. On one tree, person was obviously a gardener because the gardening tools are carved into the tree. Another person had an interest in horses, so the horses are carved into the tree. Our more interesting one that we've debated over the years and what it represents, we've decided it was a bundle of cigars, that the person was a cigar smoker, because we didn't know what it was. But back in the day, you could go to a tobacco store and buy a bundle of cigars that was wrapped with a ribbon. And that's what this is. So I don't know if today if people would memorialize themselves with their cigar, but there's probably a few people out there who would like to do that.
Probably. So when did people start turning away from buying and using large monuments with all these symbols and meanings to the more simplistic things we see today?
It's essentially World War I. World War I kind of ended that period of enlightenment that had begun in the 1800s and looking forward. And the war was devastating in terms of its death toll, its impact. And people began to move away from the larger symbols to symbols that are more simplistic. Basically, we went from what was known as a family lot to a mom and pop lot. Back in the day, everybody thought the family was going to stay together. In the modern era, we began to realize that families would be dispersed. And the markers don't carry a lot of symbolism. However, a new trend that I've noticed, but it's still gaining some steam, is the being able to use a laser to etch the image onto the monument that you want. First time I saw a person's image etched onto the monument, I wasn't comfortable with it because you were looking at the person who was dead. But it's becoming more popular, and they put more on. They'll put on their jobs, their hobbies, their cabin up north, all the different kinds of things. And lasers can do a remarkably good job on a piece of polished granite.
Well, and all these details are really interesting. It's not something that you'd initially think about when walking through a cemetery. You know, perhaps people just need to get comfortable with the idea of leisurely strolling through one. But what would you say to encourage them to look a bit closer at all the markers found?
Well, I think it's trying to be solve the mystery, understand the story that's being told by the individual so that as time passes, they are remembered. And you as walking through the cemetery will see it and you'll remember it. Often people are awed by the size of some of the monuments and that's what they remember. But most of them have some kind of symbol on them that tells you who they are or what they are. And it's interesting to know that.
Paul Halbrick is a tour guide and one of the historians of Milwaukee's Forest Home Cemetery. We spoke back in January. You can see photos of different monuments with the symbols we discussed, as well as learn more about the history of Forest Home at WUWM.com. Coming up, we meet the owners of a new plant shop in Milwaukee focused on sustainability.
There's a lot of resources and energy that goes into transporting them to the consumer. We kind of want to take that part out. We are using infrastructure that's already here in Milwaukee and going through local wholesalers.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Taking care of houseplants is a hobby many have found to be relaxing and can even boost happiness and attentiveness. Plus, being inside more during the pandemic has motivated a lot of people to add more greenery to their lives. Maggie Murphy and Sissy Butner are hoping to provide a more environmentally conscious way to grow your plant collection. They recently opened Clover MKE, and they joined me in January to talk about how their business operates. Butner starts by explaining how they're making plant collecting a little more sustainable.
All of our pots that we currently have in stock are all upcycled, repurposed items that weren't really made to be pottery for a plant. And we've just either drilled holes in it and made it, repurposed it into a pot. So most of our pottery, we can definitely say, is upcycled, repurposed, and leaning more towards sustainability.
So is that the main focus? Because I would assume cultivating, taking care of plants, that is in itself a good sustainable practice for people.
Yes, typically it is, especially once it's in your home and you're propagating and you're growing it yourself, absolutely. Plants themselves aren't necessarily the most sustainable product, just when it's like a retail product, just because of the they call them plant miles. So basically most of it is produced in Florida and California. And so there's a lot of resources and energy that goes into transporting them to the consumer. We kind of want to take that part out. We are using infrastructure that's already here in Milwaukee and going through local wholesalers. And then, you know, just cultivating those plants once they're in your home, it's a sustainable practice and it's also good for the environment and encourages people to kind of grasp and understand and love nature.
So how did the two of you become business partners?
I'm Maggie. So we both have shared a love of plants for years and years. We had mutual friends, so we probably met 7 or so, 8 years ago, and just recently reconnected via social media, sharing the same goals of opening up something plant related and kind of just decided to merge our ideas into becoming one.
So Sissy, you mentioned that you utilize the resources and the plants that are here in regards to sourcing and marketing. And that's something I wouldn't normally think about, is Milwaukee's plant market or Milwaukee's houseplant scene, so to speak. So what did you notice about it when it was a hobby for you? And what do you think you two will bring to the greater community as a business?
So when you love plants, you'll go out of your way sometimes to find a certain one. And so you might be driving from greenhouse to greenhouse, looking for the right pot, looking for the right plant, and at like reasonable prices. And so I think that cutting out that part of people having to go on a long search for a plant and bringing it right downtown to Milwaukee residents is kind of one of our goals.
And also, so many people have to drive out of state even to go and find something that they're looking for as far as rare plants go. A lot of things that you see in local greenhouses, you'll see in multiple local greenhouses versus driving, say, up north or even down to Chicago, you see a lot more of a variety. So I think that what we're offering is that rare plant and this locally sourced pot becoming one. I think people really enjoy being able to bring home an already potted plant versus, like Sissy said, going to find a plant, then trying to find a pot. Like, we're merging that idea to make it unique for everybody.
I can add on to that. This is Sissy again. A lot of times when you go to all these big box stores, a lot of times you'll find unhealthy plants or, you know, unfortunately, employees that don't necessarily know what the plant is or can't give you tips and guide to take care of it. And so we also want to offer that to our community as well, like help repotting and help with issues and any problems that a plant owner will run into. Yeah. We hope to be able to offer our insight.
You know, and that's also one benefit of having your own storefront, but you both also opened Clover in a pandemic. What were your thoughts when you realized this was a possibility to have a physical space? And what are your hopes for your space now and in the future when it's safe to be gathering again?
This is Sissy. So originally I bought a trailer so I could be a pop-up and go to farmers markets to sell plants. With Wisconsin weather, it's kind of not exactly what you can do year round. And so, you know, we're really fortunate to have somebody that reached out to us as far as retail space goes. And, you know, it's not the most ideal time when most stores are closing down. You know, we are opening up a shop, and that's pretty, you know, it's a risk.
It's scary.
It's a risk that we're willing to take for something that we're really passionate about.
I suppose it's no surprise to you both that more people are getting plants as we stay safer at home. So what is it about plants that makes you both passionate about them and want to share it with others?
This is Maggie. I just believe they offer such a nice thing to add to your home. You start a schedule because they need to be watered at different times. They freshen your air. They offer something nice to look at. And I feel like because so many people are, like you said, stuck at home, whether it be watching your kids or working from home at a desk, they just need that little pick-me-up. And I think that plants are the perfect thing right now to be able to focus on. And again, give you like a nice new schedule and something great to look at.
Yeah, absolutely helps create routine and just incomparable value. I feel like it's just, they grow and grow, and it's so wonderful to nurture something and to help it grow and be there and not, you know, sometimes they're not as demanding as a pet or a child would be. So it is always something that's relatively easy, but also demanding.
So I know you have plants at your storefront that you're in right now, but how many plants do you both personally own? And do you have a favorite right now? Or is it like picking your favorite child?
Yeah, I'm definitely over the 100 plant mark at home. As far as favorite, it just changes all the time. Always one of my personal favorites has been a watermelon peperomia. They have itty bitty circle leaves that do look just like watermelons. And I think that they're just one of the most unique looking plants that you can find.
That's always a hard question, but there's always that plant that you're kind of obsessing over for the time or giving extra care to just so you don't kill it. Right now, that's a goals for me, and just, you know, checking it daily, watching its little strands trail off the edges, measuring them, spritzing it with just the right amount of water and providing the right amount of sunlight. So, you know, sometimes it kind of shifts here and there, and also seasonally when one is in growth and one is going dormant, then you just have a bucket of soil and you're like, I'll just leave you here. So right. It definitely shifts, but I think that right now a string of turtles for me.
Well, Maggie and Sissy, I want to thank you both for taking the time to speak with me today, and best of luck as you are starting your new business.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the opportunity.
Maggie Murphy and Sissy Butner are the owners of Clover MKE. We spoke in January. And that wraps up the show for today. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of the conversations on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Join us again tomorrow at 10 for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.